and welcome to another episode of Rustation Station. I'm your host, Alan Wyma. Today, I am with Andrew Kelly, the creator of Zig. It's really a great honor to have a language creator here. Like I told him before the show, I have great respect for language creators, especially ones that can get the language very popular. Also, as you guys have probably heard in different episodes, we've been asking people what their experience with Zig is, and we haven't heard much about it. Myself, I've heard a lot of good things about Zig. The other thing on the other side is I heard people say that Zig just doesn't quite click for them as it does for Rust. So I think this is a great opportunity for people to understand, you know, what is Zig and is it actually better for them than maybe Rust or maybe something else? So Andrew, why don't you go ahead and introduce yourself and let's get started.
Hey, Alan. Nice to meet you and thanks for having me on the show. So I'm Andrew Kelly. I originally made Zig and have now transitioned into the role of president of the board of the Zig Software Foundation, as well as still the lead developer, the Zig project. So we're full steam ahead right now. We're working towards the, it's hard for me to talk about anything else because we're right super close to finishing the self-hosted compiler, which is a major milestone for any programming language.
Oh, I feel like maybe we should have waited for that to happen, no? Because, I mean, at least you know it's going to happen, right? But I feel like now just too soon to record.
Yeah, it's imminent. We're right on the edge right now. So it'd be kind of funny to review to listen to this, you know, if you're hearing the podcast after it's been released, it might be kind of funny to hear the difference in attitude and my attitude before and after.
Or could it also be difference in, you know, implementation? Maybe things change before it gets released. And it happens a lot, I believe, right?
Oh, yeah. What do they say? The last 10% takes 90% of the time.
This one I haven't heard, but I just remember the 80-20 rule that applies to so many situations. But yeah, that could also be. Is it really 90-10? I haven't heard this one.
Oh, wait. I got it. Okay. The first 90% takes 90% of the time, obviously. And then the last 10% also takes 90% of the time. That's the joke.
Okay. Got it. Yeah. I mean, as we're talking before the show for a long time, I did some research about you and Zig Lang. My understanding, maybe you can let me know if I misunderstand, but my understanding about Zig is that Zig is meant to correct the problems of C, right? Rust is a little bit different in their mindset. I think it's more about like they want to make sure things are safe when you program. And of course, by that, it's like, well, let's compare that to, you know, unsafe things such as C. But I think Zig, particularly the way that I see it, is they really are trying to replace C or correct the problems of C in particular. Is that a proper way that I could say kind of like the mission statement for Zig?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's fair. If you'll allow me to say it in my own words, I would say that Rust successfully manages to eliminate a certain category of problems, which is a really nice benefit, and Rust is succeeding in that arena. But it does that at the cost of complexity and sometimes at the cost of performance. And so this is a trade-off. And if you're willing to pay the cost for eliminating an entire class of bugs, then that's great. And Rust is excellent for that trade-off. But with Zig's approach, we're looking at the situation and saying, there's a lot we can do to improve on the C or C++ approach to things without giving up simplicity or performance. So I'd say that's kind of like the Rust-Zig trade-off in their respective domains.
Well, here's the interesting thing. People always talk about performance, right? So I hear a lot of people say, you know, I don't want to use Rust because performance will suffer. Like you said, there's some cost to it, right? But you make quite some claims about Zig, that even Zig is faster than C, right? Do you actually have some benchmarks to prove that, or is it based off of kind of like wet finger testing?
Yeah, so we can look at micro benchmarks or we can look at macro benchmarks, but at the micro level, the semantics of the language are just more optimizable. So just as an example, in C, you have a difference between signed and unsigned integers. Even though optimizers would be able to make more assumptions about unsigned integers because they have a different range, they're hamstringed by the fact that arithmetic unsigned integers in C is well defined to wrap. And for some reason, they do this split on signed, because if you use a signed integer in C, then now it's undefined behavior to wrap the integer. So now the optimization of a compiler is able to do math on signed integers better. But this is kind of a weird arbitrary situation. So as just a simple example, and Zig, arithmetic is, there's just different operators for wrapping or assertion arithmetic. So if you just use the plus operator, then you're asserting that that's not going to overflow the integer. And that's a difference with C. And you can just look at like a Godbolt example and just notice that machine code is better for unsigned integers in Zig. That's like a micro one. And then at the macro level, just take a look at the Zig self-hosted compiler. It's way faster than Clang at for an equivalent source code size. And that's just because Zig is a language that guides you towards writing faster code.
Okay. Yeah, that makes sense. It's kind of a little bit weird, right? Because like to me, I think about it, it's like they're just bits, right? I guess you could just slightly change how you interact with them. Why would you have undefined behavior that this doesn't make sense for me? Is this like a committee choice or something? Or is it like initial guys who wrote C kind of did it one way and then the committee said, okay, let's do it some other way? Do you have any idea?
Yeah, it's funny that you say they're just bits, right? You're kind of going at this at an undefined behavior angle, but if I could just side tangent real quick. The idea is you put into your head, yeah, they are just bits, aren't they? So what if we just treat all of our entire input space as bits and our output space as bits and just do the best possible thing given the hardware that we have to make the input go to the output? And that kind of modeling of programs is what makes your performance the best. But that's not what you're talking about. You're asking me about undefined behavior. Like, why can't we just define all the behavior is kind of what you're asking. Is that right?
Well, that's a second question, right? My first question is like, wait a minute, they're just bits, right? You just have to kind of treat them slightly differently, right? If you have signed, right? I think it's always the first bit is the one that's, you know, signed and unsigned. Now, if it's, sorry, plus or minus, right? If it's unsigned, then obviously you have, I don't know what the calculation is off the top of my head, but you have more data you can store, but all positive. So it's just like trying to understand, like, why is it such an issue to do this stuff? And then the second question, like you said, is why is it that we have undefined behavior, right? Why can't we just define it eventually? And then I think things would work out. But I understand that there is, you know, a code out there that is using this kind of undefined behavior. And maybe there is, I mean, the thing is undefined behavior, like literally nobody writes it. And then like somebody actually implements something and then people just rely on that. Or like, how can we say something about this kind of situation?
I think I can shed some light on this. So I think that part of what's confusing about undefined behavior for people is that it's actually a broad term, and we need to kind of narrow in on different kinds of undefined behavior. So as an example, let's just say that we took Rust and everything's the same, but we're going to make one change to the language specification. And the change is that if you ever multiply by exactly 1,000, that's undefined behavior. Okay, this would be ridiculous. This would be a really bad idea. That would only be a problem. And you would be right to ask, that doesn't make any sense. Why don't we just define multiplication by 1,000 to do what you would expect it to do? And then no one's going to run into this problem, right? Like, that's one angle. And the weird thing about C specifically, and to some degree C++, kind of by inheritance, no pun intended, is that there are some things in the specification like this. Be skeptical about what I'm about to say, because I can't remember very clearly, but I think there's something like, if your source file doesn't end in a new line, it's undefined behavior or something crazy like that. That's kind of like the multiplying by 1,000 thing, right? Like, what is that doing in there? Just get that out of there. Simplify it by taking that out, right? That's like one angle to look at undefined behavior. But there's another really important different angle to look at. And that is that the compiler needs to make some assumptions about things that will never happen so that it can do optimizations. And this is true in Rust, too. Like Rust, the Rust compiler needs to assume that certain things will never happen. And it is doing these things in order to make the output reasonable. And an example of this would be if you allocate memory from, and then you grab some memory, and I'm holding up my left hand here, and then I allocate some more memory, and I'm holding up my right hand. And the premise is that you can never access these two allocations through each other. This is called pointer provenance, and this is a really, really important assumption for compilers to make. Otherwise, they're going to out garbage code. So even Rust wants to have this assumption, and the language is built specifically so that you can never violate this premise. And that way, in the back end, when Rust emits LLVM code, it can promise LLVM, don't worry, this will never happen. You can safely assume that if one of these pointers accesses the other pointer's data, that's undefined behavior. And that assumption, that existence of undefined behavior, is what gives the optimizer the capability to do anything useful at all with the program. So that's the other angle. And I feel like sometimes the discourse on undefined behavior gets a little confused because people are thinking about one, but they're talking about the other.
So can we actually talk about undefined behavior? So I hear this term a lot, and sometimes I'm in meetings with people, with clients, and they keep using acronyms, and I ask them, what does this actually mean? And sometimes they're not even able to actually tell me. or even explain what terms mean. But like, we keep hearing this a lot in the community, right? Undefined behavior. So undefined behavior means that anything can happen, right? That there's no true definition. So you can just not expect something. Isn't that a way to actually kind of define undefined behavior?
Yeah, I mean, what you just said would be a consequence of the definition. A pithy way that I would try to say it would be, undefined behavior is a promise that the optimizer can assume will never be broken. It's a premise that it's going to operate, that's going to do its optimizations around. It's going to assume something so that it can know that it's safe to do certain changes to your code.
That sounds like more like when it's operating undefined behavior, no? That's the way I'm understanding what you're saying.
Well, specifically, though, the undefined behavior is what happens if the premise is violated. So here's an example. I can make an analogy. Let's say that you buy a computer and the motherboard has the hardware. This is a hardware analogy. It has the tech specs and it says, okay, this thing needs to be powered by 5 volts. If you give it 1 volt, it's not going to behave correctly. It needs 5 volts, right? So powering your motherboard with 1 volt, it's going to have undefined behavior. Who knows what it will do? Will it behave correctly? Will it have wrong results? Undefined. The only way to get defined behavior is give it the 5 volts that the hardware needs. That's like a hardware example. So, but we're talking about software. So just take that analogy and apply to software.
Okay. Yeah. How about Zig though? Does it actually have some undefined behavior?
Yeah. Yeah. And one of the differences between Zig and Rust is the existence of more or different categories of release modes. So Rust has a debug, which is the default, and a release, which you opt into. Zig has a debug, which is the default, and three release modes. The three release modes are small, fast, and safe. You have to choose one of these three things. You don't get all of them. So that's a difference with Rust. So in Zig, if you choose safe, then we have safety checks that check for undefined behavior and will make it defined to call panic instead of invoking undefined behavior. But if you choose small or fast, then you are opting into the optimizer assuming that undefined behavior will never happen. And then also, there are some kinds of undefined behavior that even the safe modes cannot detect. And that's an important fact for the when use cases to use Rust versus to use Zig. You know, if your goal is 100% in memory safety encapsulation, that's what Rust is going to give you. Because there are some instances in Zig where even our safe mode is not going to catch certain kinds of undefined behavior.
I want to ask a question, but I feel like the way I wanted to ask it was not proper. But do you feel that this is not something that you want to actually fix, that you want to make it really safe? I mean, because I can't imagine people saying, oh, I just want a really, really fast program. I don't really care if the memory is not safe.
Well, there's some cases where that is correct. So as an example, if you're targeting WebAssembly and you're already going to run the code in a sandbox, then there's no reason to pay the cost of safety since you're already sandboxing it in the runtime. So that'd be one example. Another example would be you're shipping a video game like Ocarina of Time to the console or a client's computer, and the player's just going to run the game on their computer. So if they manage to exploit their own system, then it just kind of doesn't matter. So that'd be another fair example. But and also answer to your question, I do have a personal goal changing this list to be roughly equivalent to like Go or Rust in terms of safety. So as an example, one of the problem areas right now would be escaped pointers to local variables. So you have a function, take the address of a local variable, and then you store that somewhere, and then the function returns. That pointer now becomes a dangling pointer, and if you use it, that's called a use after free. Now, there is an important difference between Zig and Rust here, which is that in Rust, the existence of that pointer is already undefined behavior. I hope someone can correct me if I'm wrong. I might be wrong about this exact example, but I know that Rust does have an important distinction about even creating like bad types, even if they're never like loaded or stored, that's already undefined behavior. Whereas in Zig, only an access would cause the problem. So you can actually store it fine as long as you never load or save it later. Anyway, my point is that I do actually have a plan to address this, which is to do escape analysis on local variables, heap allocate them with an allocator that does not reuse virtual memory addresses, free them at the end of the function, and then these no longer will cause use after free. They'll cause either a seg fault or undefined value will be caught. So in summary, there's two answers to this question. One is it's actually okay to take certain risks for certain targets. And number two is, I actually do want to bring this list down roughly to Go or Rust safety level, but you know, we're not at 1.0 yet. So, you know, check back then and you can evaluate the safety of Zig at that point in time.
Yeah, that was actually what I wanted to ask next was like, you know, Rust has this thing that since 1.0, they always want to remain backwards compatible. Is Zig going to have the same kind of guarantees?
1.0? Yeah, yeah. Our goal is to pretty much just never touch the language again after 1.0.
Now, that could be a catalyst to have a never releasing 1.0 kind of stage. Is that the way you see it happening, or you actually see a 1.0 happening sometime relatively soon?
Yeah, I mean, I see what you're saying, but it's offset by the fact that the language is just so much simpler than other languages. So while, yes, it's still a monumental amount of work, it is lessened by the fact that the language doesn't require... It's a much more finite set of language features than other projects.
So I do know that people are using Zig in production, right? And so how are they handling, like, if there is changes to the language, right? Is there an upgrade guide, or is there, like, I think in some languages they have, like, a tool that which can scan the code and change it for you. Do you have something like this?
Yeah, we have both of these things. Yeah, so if any listeners to this podcast right now, I would encourage you to go to the Zig website and just look at the latest release notes for, I don't know, 0.9.0. And then just scroll down in awe of 2 weeks that I just spent typing away these notes in very laboriously, but I jest. But also, yeah, we sometimes are able to have the Zig formatter tool auto upgrade things. It doesn't have type awareness, so it's limited in what it can do. But when it can, it's pretty ideal.
Now, what kind of things does it actually do for you? Does it rename variables? Does it just change the syntax? Or what kind of things does it actually do for you?
You're asking about the formatter?
Yeah, the formatter and if it does actually change and upgrade your code for the new version.
Yeah, I mean, it's a pretty standard formatter. If you've ever used Go format, it's pretty much the same. I don't have any experience with Rust format. I don't know how that works. But yeah, there's no configuration options. It's opinionated, so everyone has to use the same style. And then what we do is just, I don't know, let's say that one of the built-in functions gets renamed. It's able to just do that rename for you. And I forget what I was going to say, but it doesn't have access to type information. So the only thing you can do is syntactical changes.
So that must be at like the AST or something like that kind of level.
Mm-hmm. The main purpose of the formatter is just reformat the code. So double purposing it, do language upgrades, sometimes works and sometimes does not work.
Please don't tell me that you also add underscores between the thousands place in numbers, do you?
Automatically?
Yeah.
No. I actually rejected that language proposal for a while, but then I caved.
Okay.
To even support underscores and integer literals at all.
I totally am okay with that, but what I really hate is like a formatter that I use for Elixir. They only, like you said, it's also opinionated, right? It follows very much the same ideas. But for some reason, they decided to automatically add the thousands separator, the underscores in between. And it drives me nuts because sometimes I have an integer that actually is a reference for something from a client. And it's like, okay, you know, I format all the time because I want my code to look okay. But then I do Command F or Command Shift F, try to find that integer, and I cannot find it because it's
been
formatted. Drives me nuts.
That's annoying. Also, that's a regional thing. So if you put something in the thousands place, then that might actually just not be what a different culture does. So it's just kind of weird.
You know, it's opinionated, so what can I do? But that's my biggest gripe. Otherwise, everything else is fine. I don't really care too much about other stuff. It's kind of nice having a formatter opinionate because you don't need to fight about code style. Just run the formatter and go.
Yeah, that's the idea. Yeah. We do have a kind of a nice thing where if you want to put... So Zig just supports commas at the end of lists and stuff. I think Rust does too, if I remember correctly. So like enums or structs or even function calls. Anyway, point being, if you just trail an extra comma, the formatter will actually notice that and then say, I see that you wanted to put everything on a separate line. I'll just go ahead and do that for you. And then likewise, if you delete the trailing comma, it'll say, okay, I guess you want me to put it all in one line. Okay, I'll go ahead and do that. You kind of communicate to the formatter based on the existence of the trailing comma or not.
I kind of really like that because like it does affect me because I don't want to like add in a bunch of artificial changes. It's like, okay, I just want to add an extra item to the end of this list. Well, that means I have to actually change two lines, which is just annoying.
That's a good reason for things on different lines. Yeah.
Kind of reminds me of when I worked in the bank before and like the most productive person according to Git changes was actually the configuration guy who would just manage YAML files all day. Because you'd just be adding and removing stuff.
Mm.
And then eventually decided to start gamifying his work. Because, you know, you just add a space, remove a space, commit it. And then At the end of the day, look how many lines of code you changed this month. You tripled your output. What's going on? You're doing a good job. Here's a raise.
Oh, wow. Wait, so their performance was actually being measured by lines of code?
So when I was working in the bank, we were working on, you know, cost allocations, right? Because here's the thing is that IT people, how do you judge the value of a person? If you sit down with somebody, you're assigned to help them optimize their workday, right? Usually it means writing a piece of software. But let's say that you did all your checking, and all of a sudden at the end of the day, you say, actually, if you just remove these pieces and then connect this stuff and whatever, you can actually save yourself 3 hours or whatever, right? Just give you an idea. There's times when you're a developer, I'm sure you know this, where you can find ways to improve without actually writing a piece of code.
To improve your own skill or to improve some of the company's infrastructure or what?
You can improve the company's way of doing things, right? So a lot of times people say, okay, I want to make my process better. Let me just get the developer to write software for me so then I can just drag and drop and go on my day. It's like, well, wait a minute. This file's coming from Dropbox and you want it just to email to this person. So why not just have Dropbox automatically send the invite and share the link and then you're ready to go. Oh, I didn't know you could do that. Okay. Honestly, like you can find simple things without writing a piece of code or a line of code.
Yeah.
And how do you measure that?
Yeah, you need a human actually using critical thinking in order to measure that.
Exactly. And also, like, I mean, another thing too is if you're pair programming, which is what we did a lot also, how do you measure that? Because if I'm telling you what to write and you're just typing away, technically, I think the guy who's got the idea and it works very well is probably contributing more, right? I mean, you're just typing out the stuff. We can discuss that one, but that's my thought on it. So now it's the guy who wrote everything who gets all the credit.
Mm-hmm.
So, like,
yeah, I see what you're saying.
Because the thing is, IT salaries are quite high in relative comparison to like a regular clerk. So how do you judge the value?
Yeah. Well, I will say one thing. I think that how you judge the value is different depending on if you're a large company or a small one.
In any case, they basically had four buckets, right? Equipment, people's salaries, IT equipment, because you know servers and stuff are not cheap, and IT salaries, because IT salaries are rather high in comparison for the same people. And over here, they just keep trying to get more developed. Anyways, I'm talking too much about my own stuff, right? But in general, right? I forgot why we got onto this topic. But yeah, I mean, judging value is really difficult.
I completely agree that judging value is of human contributions is very difficult.
Okay, so where were we going with this? Yeah, so maybe this is a good time since we both kind of, I think at least for me, I lost my way where I was going with everything. Why don't we talk more about your past, right? Because I think it gives us a good idea about, you know, where you came from and why you decided to get onto this path. Now, you started off, you're definitely doing higher level languages, right, at the beginning?
Yeah, earlier on, yeah, I started with Visual Basic 6. I did Perl, Python, JavaScript, C++, Java, C, then Rust, then I made Zig.
Now, VB is kind of known, or not a very popular language, right? At the time, though, I guess it worked out for you, no?
I mean, for a 12-year-old, it was awesome.
Okay, fine, 12 years old, okay. I can't judge a 12-year-old, I guess. Yeah, I just know that in the programming world that people would say, oh, VB is not good, etc. I never really got into VB. I never really did BASIC. I think I did BASIC once when I was playing around with robots in university. We had a class called Build Your Own Robot Army, and we were actually able to write BASIC for something.
Wait, you were doing some kind of like software arena, like bots fighting each other?
Well, the name of the course was How to Build Your Own Robot, Evil Robot Army was actually the name of the course. So,
oh, wow.
So for my school, it's a trimester school. So you got your spring, you got your fall, but in the middle of January, it's something called J-term. So you can take off, which doesn't really make sense because in general, you pay for that, right? You can take a trip, which I did also one time I went to China, and that's actually part of a course, right? And then the other one is that you could take a course. You sit in class about 4 hours a day, every day for like the whole month, and you can get the course done. So it could be maybe you get a missing credit that you need. Some courses are only taught in J-term. And sometimes there's courses like that, which are kind of like fun courses. You get the credit and everything, but they're more fun, right? Building robots every day for 4 hours is kind of fun.
That sounds great.
Exactly.
Was there hardware involved?
It was all hardware in the beginning. And then at the very end, we had a special chip that we could actually program.
Wow. Wait, so you said a robot army? So were you making them like swarm or something?
First of all, names may be confusing, right? So the name of the course was How to Build Your Own Evil Robot Army, but we were not making swarms of armies of robots. I wish we were. That would be fun, but maybe not enough time and 4 hours a day for only the month of January.
Okay, so you made one robot.
I made several different robots, and I think they were basically build a robot and then disassemble it and then make a new one.
That sounds really cool.
It's like over 10 years ago, right? I'm getting old over here. I can't remember exactly what we did. Yeah, It was something like that, right? So it sounds cool, but the details...
I would have done anything to take that class when I was young.
Yeah, I'm not saying it wasn't fun, but why are we talking about this again? I totally forgot.
Oh, you said that you heard that Visual Basic was a bad language.
Oh, yeah. Sorry. Yeah, so yeah, Visual... And then I remember that for programming, that was actually Basic, right? And that was my first and only time ever actually using Basic. So quite basic in terms, right? But I do know that Basic was a huge thing, right? I mean, Microsoft wrote Basic, I think, for the first Apple or the second, or Apple II, I think it was. They sold Basic to one of those original switches for that computer. What is that? The Altair, I think it was.
Yeah, that's before my time. You're teaching me history at this point.
I would thought you would know this stuff, no?
Yeah, maybe I'm only 33.
We're about the same age. I'm just, the problem is that I love you too much. That's the issue. But in any case, right? So you did VB at 12 years old. What kind of stuff are you doing with VB, by the way?
You know, as much as I could, but also not that much. My parents only let me use the computer, actually any electronics, for 1 hour a day. Which, as you know, programming is a pretty time-consuming hobby, so it was pretty challenging. I read a lot of books and then like planned out everything I would do on paper so that when I like got my hour, I would just like put it in the computer as fast as possible. But I don't know, I forget what your actual question was.
No, I was just curious about what you were actually kind of programming with, but I can understand. Like, so was it like, it's kind of like you were acting like programmers were a long time ago, where it's like you had to wait in line to drop your card into the machine.
Yeah, kind of. Yeah. But even though it was sitting right there, I just wasn't allowed to use it most of the time. Yeah, I would just try anything. So what did I do? I tried to make like a WYSIWYG website editor, which did not work very well. I made a lot of games without learning anything about game design yet. So I have a lot of like bad game ideas that I did. I did make one kind of fun thing, which was like a macro recorder. So it would record your keyboard and mouse movements and then replay them. And I actually managed to prank my high school teacher with that one years later. So that was pretty funny. Yeah, I mean, to me, just experimenting with like the Windows APIs and just learning how to code was really fun.
So from there on, you're like, wow, I really want to continue working on with computers or continue programming? Or were you just like, this is just fun to play around with at the beginning?
Well, I had a lot of hobbies. I also got into animation. I was really involved in Albino Black Sheep back in the day. I got into using FL Studio to try to make music. I tried learning piano. What else? I wanted to like build hardware, but I just wasn't smart enough to figure out how to get started. And none of the adults around me figured out that they needed to just buy me a book on hardware. And I didn't know that that's what I needed. So that never happened. But anyway, there's alternate universes in which I have many different specialties. But yeah, in this one, I landed on software.
Yeah, I think I hear that in some podcasts. Like, if you weren't a developer, what would you be? And you hear some interesting answers. Some of them actually like a farmer or artist.
Yeah.
Sounds like you have many different possibilities.
Yeah, I just love to create, you know.
So what happened after VB, right? So after some time, you're playing with VB. And then, like, when do you think you really started to realize that, hey, this is actually what I want to do? I want to program. I love this.
I think it's just the hobby that I kept coming back to. So, you know, when it came time to pick a major in college, it was an obvious choice to go with computer science. That's basically it. Not much more to say there.
And what was your first job actually out of university?
Amazon.com. It was the worst job I ever had. I started looking for a different job after just 3 months after moving across the country for this dream job out of college.
Wow. I'm sure a lot of people at home are thinking like, wow, that doesn't make any sense, because we all want to work for Amazon because they're one of the biggest Rust hirers or kind of Rust places out there, I would say.
Amazon is really good at treating programmers like cogs in a machine. So you're not going to have a good experience at Amazon, but you will be exploited for labor effectively. And Jeff Bezos will make a lot of money and you'll quit soon after like a year because of the high attrition rate. But it doesn't matter because someone will replace you and they've designed a system where everyone is replaceable. It sucks. Don't work there.
But I mean, as a business owner, right? For me, I can give the idea that, hey, I do want people to be replaceable because you don't want to rely your whole business on somebody.
Yeah. I mean, if your only goal is to make money. Yeah.
Well, I mean, not about that, right? You need to be able to handle people leaving, especially for tech, right? People always change jobs. That's kind of presumed. Oh, you're still at the same job for what? 2 years? That doesn't make sense. Why don't you change jobs?
I think so. I mean, okay. I see what you're saying, right? Your point is that the business needs to survive, you know, like regular, healthy employee turnover, which is a fair point. But you also need to, from another angle, people need to have a place where they can fit in and they can feel like they're doing important work. And if you are just completely replaceable, you're not doing important work. You don't have a place to fit in. And it's not a happy, fulfilling job. Like at some point, in order to just have a healthy working environment, you have to give people some autonomy and some responsibility and some meaning.
So what do you think would be a healthy situation between an employer and employee, where an employer, their employee is replaceable, but still not quite replaceable? I'm not sure how you'd even define that in a way that is easily understandable from the employer side.
I mean, I think this is a pretty natural phenomenon. So if you take any average company who's hiring, they're spending company resources trying to find a new candidate, right? And when that person, if they find someone qualified and they join, they then have to train them, they have to catch them up to speed, and that person has to take time to get familiar with not only like the code, but also the people and how to work well with other people and all the nuances of everyone's personalities and that sort of thing. What is that called? Institutional knowledge? I forget what it's called. But I mean, this, we already have words for these things, right? This is already just an observable phenomenon in the real world. And companies generally don't want people to quit too much or too fast. They don't want a high attrition rate because it's inefficient to be hiring all the time. It's more efficient for the existing people to invest in your existing employees and have them do good work and better work as they get more and more familiar and power and ability within the organization to accomplish the goals that help the organization. So I don't think I'm saying something outrageous. I mean, I think I'm just describing an existing phenomenon, and I'm just pointing out that Amazon has optimized for a high attrition rate. They said, fine, if you all are going to quit because it sucks to work here, we're just optimize our business around that being a premise. So screw you. We don't care if you're happy or not.
Yeah. I mean, I understand from both sides, right? It's like you want to feel valued. You want to feel like you fit in. You want to have all this kind of stuff. But at the same time, it's like, well, people naturally will go wherever they want to go. I mean, it depends on the motivation, right? Some people are motivated by money. There's not much you can do about that. Some people are motivated by whatever, right? Whatever the motivation is. I mean, there's been some people who, like I recently hired some guy. He said, you know, I really want to work here. I just didn't have anything for him to work at the time. So I just said, hey, you have to wait for a moment. And he was basically like, listen, I really want to work with you. I got some other offers, but, you know, I'm willing to wait, but I can't wait for so long, right? Because he's got things to handle, right? So, I mean, there's this kind of thing, right? But there's other people who are just like, oh, I got this, you know, I got this offer today. You know, what can you do about it? Can you match it? It's like, well, you know, how do I handle that, right? Like, why are you actually here? Do you actually want to be here?
Mm-hmm.
So that's, I mean, there's so many ways to look at it, right? But it's good to hear your side. And I think you have some points, obviously.
Yeah. I mean, you're talking to someone who's running a nonprofit. So we obviously have different motives than a company whose explicit goals are to give a return on an investment.
Well, yeah, I mean, but you're also, for a nonprofit, you also have to explain, okay, I pay this money for this person, then, you know, here's the output, right? As a nonprofit, I think you have to have something like that. Every time you spend money, I think you have to kind of justify it.
Yeah, how it works for nonprofits is you have a mission statement, which is public. You can go look at ours on our homepage. And your legal responsibility is to spend all of your funds, all of them. So nobody gets any, you know, there's no leftover funds in a nonprofit. You have to spend all your funds serving the mission statement. So when people donate money to us, then presumably what they're thinking is, that's a mission statement I can stand behind. I trust the people involved that they are going to use this money to work towards that mission statement.
You know what? I think this is a perfect segue. I do want to go back to your career, but I think this is a perfect segue since you're already thinking about the nonprofit. Rust has a nonprofit, right? And I did interview Rebecca Rumbel. The episode's not out yet at the time of this recording, but she did quite explain about what their mission statement is and what they're doing. Can you talk a little bit more about what Zig mission statement is and what you guys are doing as a nonprofit?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, so we're a 501c3, same as the Python Software Foundation. And we actually published all of our financial transactions recently. So you can just go look them up if you want, every single one. That's all open. And if you do that, what you'll find is that almost all the money goes directly towards paying contributors who are working on the Zig project. And that's something I'm really proud of. It's a really efficient organization, and it's using the donations that we get to send that money directly to the people who deserve it for working on Zig. Now, to be clear, there are people, a lot of people who are doing really good work and they're not getting paid. They're just volunteering their time for the open source project. I would love to pay them if we had more budget, but obviously we have to spend wisely and not too much.
Well, I mean, I guess you can kind of disclose, like, what are some of the developers actually getting paid? Are they getting paid per patch or some kind of weekly thing or a stipend, or what kind of thing are usually they getting paid with?
Everyone has a pretty similar contract. It's $50 per hour. They set whatever schedule they want, and the like what they're supposed to work on is intentionally loose so that they can decide what they think is best for the Zig project. And they get paid for their time, no questions asked. Because the thing that we were able to do is pick people who already demonstrated intrinsic motivation to help the project. So for example, one of our full-time hires is Jakub Konka. He does awesome work. And the thing is, he was already volunteering his free time before he became a full-time hire. So it's kind of an advantage that we have over a startup because he demonstrated before he even saw any money that he cared about the project, he wanted to succeed, and that he could self-direct. So he doesn't require management. He just knows what he wants to do, and he has a good sense for it already. I don't need to tell him what to do. And that contract is the same kind that everyone has. So everyone has a high level of trust, and they're paid by the hour. Their schedule is whatever they want it to be, and their tasks are self-directed.
Now, that's not a huge amount of money. I mean, $50 an hour, I think, is not a lot in comparison to other companies, especially, like you said, Amazon. So, I mean, the motivation is probably not money, obviously, right?
My understanding is that, well, actually, I'm going to try and protect the privacy of people, so I don't want to say too much, but my understanding that it's a comfortable rate for those who are getting it in not the United States. But also, I do want to see that higher. I do want to keep the rate competitive. And I think that as we move forward, I think that we'll be able to take in more donations. And I think that we will be able to do that. I'm hoping that that is the case within the next couple of years.
I mean, the way I look at it, right, I think, yeah, you're right. Overseas, that could be quite a bit of money. But let's just say the person is in like US or one of these kind of higher level European countries. Now, in that case, right, you could say, okay, this is not really meant for them to necessarily live on, but it is meant for them to say like, thank you. And then they could use that to say, maybe get a new laptop that they could use for contributing more. Like the new M1 chips are coming out. Those ones could help them compile faster, just to give an idea. These kind of things, right? More like a thank you and here's some, you know, compensation, and then you could do with it however you want. That's kind of a way I look at it, at least.
Yeah, we do have some part-time contractors as well. And I think that it functions more like that for the part-time contractors, where they, for whatever reason, are not able or willing to go full-time on Zig, or we don't have the funds to pay them, but they're able to do some side work, you know, part-time, and have a little bit of extra spending money at the same rate.
I mean, how do you guys decide what's going to be in the next release? I mean, if you said, it sounds like people are really autonomous, but then there must be like a milestone listed on GitHub and then all the issues attached to it, and people just kind of pop it off the stack whenever they feel like they want to work towards a new release, no?
Yeah, so there's issues on there, and that's to help. The issues are to help coordinate between people. So that's what those are there for. I have a vision for what I think is important, and I do my best to share and inspire, but I don't dictate. I mean, I do review code, and I do veto technical decisions, and I do guide the technical aspects of what is in scope of the project and what we're working towards. But I don't dictate the tasks of what people decide they want to work on. So as an example, we know that we want to have Zig support for the major operating systems, Linux, Windows, Mac OS. We know that we want the self-hosted compiler to have its own linker for these three operating systems for various reasons. Now, personally, my priorities would be like Windows x86, Linux x86, my priorities. Eventually, I'd want to get Mac OS too. But for Jakub, Mac OS is really important to him. And so that's what he's been focusing a lot of time on. And that's great. I'm happy about that. And thanks to that, we've had, Zig has a cross-compiling, a cross-linker for Mac OS that other projects don't have access to. And if it were me, that's not what I would have prioritized my time on. But that's great. That is something that we want. That's in scope. And I'm thrilled that that's something that Jakub is enthusiastic about and that he's managed to push to this level of quality.
Well, that's great. As somebody who's an avid Mac user, and let me make it clear, the main reason I really want, well, I like using Mac. It fits well for me, and it's like a kind of a major OS. But the other thing, too, that I have to say, like in general, like I build iOS apps for some clients, and I just cannot do that in other ways. I mean, there are services I could use, but in general, like run the app and develop on my machine directly. Mm-hmm. So I'm kind of limited to that. So this makes sense for me to buy Mac. So for that Mac OS support, it makes it more attractive for me, at least.
Yeah, that makes sense. The new M1s are pretty nice. Those pretty nice machines.
Yeah, we can go into, you know, M1 Ultra versus the other one. I've heard weird benchmarks, but they're basically about the same. So you may be paying extra for something, which is not great in terms of most tasks. Maybe long-running ones, it might win out. But for some short-term ones, it doesn't really make sense.
Mm.
But yeah, okay. I think that's a good kind of overview. Kind of going back, okay, so you worked at Amazon. Obviously, I don't think you enjoyed your time there, as you made it, you know, indirectly clear. But then, you know, what you're doing, and then of course, I think everybody knows that you were working at, what was that dating website? OkCupid, right? Mm-hmm. Before it was actually called OkCupid, but before OkCupid, you think you also had some work you were doing too, right?
Yeah, I did a bunch of work at startups. Worked at a couple music startups, worked at Backtrace. I think that's it.
And where was it that, because I know before OkCupid, you're working on Zig, right? Like, what was the motivating factor where you're like, okay, I want to build this thing? Were you working with Zig at the time and you were just so frustrated by all these issues? Or was it just like you wanted to have fun? Or, you know, what was the motivating factor?
Yeah, I was working on a digital audio workstation in C++. And yeah, running into a lot of issues. Actually, you know what? I tried a bunch of different languages for that project. I tried Go and I realized that it was not powerful enough, not low level enough. I actually gave Rust a really solid shot for the digital audio workstation. And this was pre-1.0, so with the caveat that I'm sure the experience is a lot smoother these days. Back then, I really struggled to be productive. The learning curve was very steep for me. I spent a month just trying to do some basic kind of like font rendering stuff for a GUI. And I mean, I got it working, but then I found that the way I built it didn't abstract properly. So it felt like even though I'd finally got it working, I couldn't even use my code. Didn't know how to build on it. Anyway, long story short, I had to be honest with myself and I realized I am not productive with Rust. I am not making enough progress at a speed that is satisfactory to myself. So at that point, I switched to C++, and despite all of its flaws, I did experience a lot more productivity and I was able to get a lot further in a shorter amount of time on the project with C++. But still, I mean, none of these things were ideal for me. So at that point, you know, I'd ping-ponged back for a bunch of different languages, and having had just compared all of them for this one use case, I had a pretty clear idea of what I wanted, and that's when I started Zig.
How did you kind of prep yourself for writing a language? I mean, that's a huge endeavor, no?
Yeah, step one is just get in it, git touch readme, commit, then make a source directory. I mean, I'm just being facetious, but point being, you just start, you just go. The first thing I did was I tried to write a parser generator. Instead of using a parser generator, I tried to make one. And a few weeks, I just gave up because that's way too hard. I was not able to do that. And I just started doing recursive descent, and that was way easier. This is just the first problem I ran into. So I don't know. You just start, and then you run into problem after problem after problem. And if you don't give up, then eventually you have something.
I think my biggest question is, like, if you're coming from higher level languages, even if you did C and C++, like, designing the language, I mean, there's a lot of things you need to know, a lot of things you need to consider. Like, how does this stuff actually work? Like, if you, once you know how to get to the bytecode, then LLVM, you could just kick out finally machine code at the end, right? Or binary code, whatever you want to call it, the final end product, right? But Zig is not using LLVM, right? They're using something else, or how does it actually work?
You're characterizing me as coming from higher level languages, but I think that might not be accurate because, I mean, I had been using C++ even professionally for a while, and I had done a project where I statically recompiled Nintendo games to native executables using LLVM. So, I mean, I was pretty familiar with a bunch of low-level stuff. And for that project, I wrote a disassembler and assembler. I had to learn about JIT. I had to learn about a lot of stuff. So, I mean, I definitely was familiar with a lot of these topics. It wasn't just me going from high-level languages and then making a low-level language. Also, to answer your question, the Zig compiler that everyone is using today is using LLVM, and the self-hosted compiler that is imminently shipping, it has a LLVM backend. It also has a C backend, a native x86 backend, a native ARM backend, a native WebAssembly backend, even a SpearV backend. These are all at various levels of completion. The LLVM backend is the most complete.
Oh, now I feel a bit embarrassed. I didn't know so much about these details, but yeah, okay. Like I said,
Worries. Yeah, no shade on you. I just wanted to make sure the listeners didn't think that I was a green, you know, language user when I started making Zig.
No, and I think that's fine, right? I mean, nobody, like, when you started those pieces, right, you have pretty much no idea, like, how do you actually learn them? Did you actually crack open a book and start reading, or did you reading stuff online? Or, I mean, I have no idea, like, where you even would start to learn these kind of pieces and why.
I just spent a lot of time practicing.
And 1 hour chunks, right?
Yeah. Well, yeah, at some point I moved out of my parents' house and I spent a lot more than 1 hour a day on the computer.
Wait. Was this similar to like once you move out of your parents' house, you start eating ice cream all the time because there's nobody telling you not to?
Yep, that's exactly right. I'm doing the kid who lives under a rock and then drinks too much alcohol in college, except for computers.
Kind of reminds you of that Amish TV show. I think I've seen the bits and pieces on TLC. Have you seen that one?
No, I don't know what you're talking about.
There's a show, I really haven't watched the whole episode, but I've seen bits and pieces where these people who are Amish, I think they have like, when you're getting to just about being an adult in their community, you're allowed to kind of go out and have like a crazy wild weekend or day, and they get to experience, you know, electricity, drinking, bikinis, you know, stuff that's just not in the community. And then they kind of come back and say, yeah, I think I want to stay, you know, here. Or they say, you know what, the world outside a little bit more interesting. Goodbye. That's what I understand, right? So don't take it as my word.
It's like the Amish purge.
Yeah, something like that. So they actually videotape it on TLC and you're like, wow, these guys are wild. But, you know, like we talked about before, hey, you know, if you never had a chance to go out and do things, when you do get the opportunity, you may not be able to control yourself.
Yeah, I don't know if that's real or not. Maybe it is, but here we are.
Yeah, so, okay, it's good to hear it. Because I wouldn't know if you actually use LLVM or not, because it wasn't clear for me. I know Rust definitely makes it clear, and also I'm more in the community of Rust than I am with Zig, so it wasn't super clear to me that you guys are using that. Because I was like, how can you guys optimize and be faster than C? But that's must be...
we're talking about runtime performance, right? So that's related to the fact that it's using LLVM. Here's what I'll say. It's hard to beat LLVM's performance at runtime. And it's hard not to beat LLVM's performance at compile time.
Oh, okay. I see. Yeah, yeah. Well, that's one of the things that Rust is famous for. Now, so because you guys are using LLVM, is there also a slow compilation problem too? Because that's kind of also what Rust is known for. But that may also be because borrow checker.
If you look at the timings of a Zig compilation today, it's 90% waiting for LLVM. But that's the thing though. So this new self-hosted compiler that we're shipping soon, it's going to ship with the LLVM backend. That's the first step. But we have the x86 backend. What is it? 60% done or something like that. So when this one gets done, that's no LLVM. So what we're going to have is we're basically following in D's footsteps, which is you have a pure self-hosted compiler for debug builds. And the purpose of those is to go fast, compile fast, so you can have that quick iteration time, you know, edit, compile, test cycle. And then when you want to create your production build, then you're going to do a release build and you're going to use the LLVM backend for that. Take a little bit longer, get better results.
Now, I'm kind of curious. So why did you take LLVM over, say, GCC? I mean, I always hear that GCC is really good, but I think there's some issues with it. When I hear the difference between LLVM and GCC is that GCC is like all optimizations built into it because of history. And LLVM is kind of catching up.
And they're kind of neck and neck. They're some cases one of them wins, some cases the other one wins. The two reasons are license. LLVM has a liberal license. GCC has GPL. Zig is MIT, so GCC license is just not compatible. And the other one is just older and cruftier. So, I mean, LLVM is already a behemoth, and it already has its own cruft, but GCC has more.
Okay, yeah, because I know in Rust, like, there's some people working on GCC support, and there's a lot of people really interested in that. And like I said, what I told you is what I understood about GCC versus LLVM, but I don't know how true that is and what exactly why people are interested, because you're making it sound like LLVM is really much better in terms of licensing, of course, but performance you're saying is really similar.
I'm saying it's similar, yeah. I don't know where we're at with one versus the other. I think Phoronix has a bunch of comparison benchmarks. If you want to know the latest, you can probably find it there.
Okay. The other thing I thought was very interesting, I want to kind of get back more on your career, is that like you basically said, hey, you know, I really wanted to work on Zig. I think right after you left OkCupid, right? I think that's when you really went focusing full time, or do you have one more thing before that, one more gig?
I did quit OkCupid directly to go full time on Zig. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. And you went full time on Zig and you actually did it really mathematically. And I thought it was kind of interesting and makes a lot of sense. It's like, okay, now I have enough cash and the way things are going with donations, like I'm going to like get very close to being at rock bottom and then be able to start going up from there. Right. I thought that was super interesting and I'm happy.
Yeah.
You're very much a programmer and you're like very analytical about this, looking at like a graph, I guess, and everything.
It was very stressful. My fiance was very supportive of me during that time. You know, you look at the data, but you kind of almost can't believe your eyes, and it helps to have that other person saying, yeah, the numbers check out. You can quit your job, and saying, okay, yeah, okay, I'm going to do it.
Yeah, I mean, having a supportive SO is really helpful, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I can't imagine too many people that would be like standing by you, but yeah, I understand. I guess you must have really talked about your passion for this, and then that was like the kind of the thing. It's okay, let's just do it. Let's have a try, right?
Oh, you mean by way of kind of like convincing her to go along with it?
I mean, it's not about convincing, right? It's like, hey, I really want to do this. And then I think that your passion alone should probably already convince them, hey, let's just give it a shot, right?
Yeah, that sounds about right.
I don't think it's really much of convincing. It's just like, okay, I trust you and let's give it a try.
Yeah.
Did you also have to bring her data too and really justify all your use cases? Do you have to give her an elevator pitch and everything?
Yeah, I think I'm the one who is a little more focused on making sure that crunching the numbers and make sure the bottom line is black. So I think ultimately I had to convince myself, I think.
Okay. But I'm guessing that she's in line like, okay, this is really working out. I'm happy we did it.
Oh, yeah. She said that I was just obviously having some sort of a crisis of every day having to go to work when I wanted to not be going to work and working on this other thing. And it was just a, I don't know, there's a difference in someone's aura, you know, when they're working on what they want to do with their life rather than, you know, being a wage slave. So obviously it's been nice.
Yeah. I mean, when you work on something you really want to work on, I can also justify this. I'm working longer hours, but I feel happier overall because I'm doing things that I actually want to do. So mm-hmm. I totally understand.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, maybe we can kind of start to wrap up with some final points, right? So Zig is going towards a hosted compiler. Is there any other kind of short-term things that are going to be happening sometime soon?
Short-term? Yeah. Well, I'll tell you what's happening. In a couple of weeks, we're having the first ever Zig meetup in Milan, Italy. So yeah, about, I don't know, 40 people, it looks like. It should be pretty fun.
Yeah, I mean, people may laugh about 40 people, but we have a saying in Asia, or at least in China, is like every, was it 1,000-kilometer march starts with one step, right? So 40 people now, it could be triple that the next time. I have no idea. Like I said, I do see there's a community for Zig. And
yeah,
because people don't make it doesn't mean that people don't care.
Well, this is the first one. So, I mean, as far as I'm concerned, the smaller the better, right? Because I like more intimate gatherings. So the way I see it is, I'm going to enjoy the smaller numbers while they last, because in the future, they're going to be much bigger and it's going to have to be a different affair, you know?
The other thing too is that I'm sure you're finding out doing a conference is a whole different thing. I've never done it before, but I've talked to people about them and it's a lot of work.
Thankfully, I can thank Loris for that. Lori Crow is doing all the setup. He lives in Milan and he's set up the room and organizing and doing all the stuff that I would find it very difficult to stay on top of. So all I have to do is show up, which is super nice for me.
So please don't mess this one up, please. Right.
Yeah.
You get the one job.
Exactly.
Yeah. I hope you don't feel too much pressure on that part. Right. It's always like that. It's like, was it Occam's Razor? Is that the one where it's like something that can go wrong or something like that?
I forgot. You're thinking of Murphy's Law.
Sorry, Murphy's Law. Yeah. Occam's Razor is the one about like the most obvious answer is the one that's true or something. I forgot now.
Occam's Razor is if your explanation includes unnecessary pieces of explanation, then just remove the unnecessary pieces because you don't need them.
Yeah, there it is. Again, I'm still waking up, as I told you this morning. It's 10:30 almost, so.
Yeah, that's fair. You got some coffee there?
Yeah. If I didn't have coffee, I think I would, I don't know, if I would be able to even live. It's like my lifeblood.
Nice. Ask me what kind of tea I'm drinking.
What kind of tea are you drinking?
This tea is oolong tea. It's thematic. Are you ready? It's called Iron Goddess of Mercy.
There's a tea called tea is Cantonese word for steel or no, iron. So I'm wondering if that's the same one.
I don't know. I picked it because we're doing the Rust podcast.
But Gwin Yum is like a famous like mythological person in the Chinese community. And also I think it's the same person who was like, there's also a woman in like the Indian stuff that changes shape. It's actually similar, right? The India and China, they have a lot of similarities with their mythology.
Well, that makes sense since they're next to each other.
Also the British, right? British brought, you know, Indians over to Hong Kong and then, you know, Hong Kong, you know, they mixed together, et cetera, right? So a lot of this kind of stuff, trading and all that.
That makes sense.
But yeah, I mean, I would love to chat some more, but I do have something I need to do relatively soon. I appreciate your time. Maybe we can kind of wrap up with kind of some, maybe if you have some last minute kind of calls you want to call people to, calls to action, maybe people to come check out the language, contribute, go to the conference, anything.
Let's see. So we have a bunch of Rust audience members, right? They're all probably pretty happy using Rust. They're great. They don't need any calls to action. You know, if they feel inspired and they want to throw some donation money our way, that's always welcome. You can find a link on the homepage, zigling.org. But it's all good, you know? We can all use the tools that work best for us. No problem.
Yeah, I think my call to action is just give it a try, especially if you feel like you're struggling with Zig or you think that maybe Rust doesn't work for everything. Sorry, struggling with Rust, not struggling with Zig. Give it a try. Maybe you find a new love, right? You never know until you try. I never would have predicted I would be really into Rust as I am right now. So maybe if I do try Zig, maybe I have Zig Station Station after this. I don't know.
Zig Station Station? Yeah, you might have to come up with a new pun.
I don't know. If you have any ideas.
Iguana Sauna.
Why Iguana? Is that the mascot?
Or Ziguana, sorry. Yeah. It's like the Rust Station, right? It's a Ziguana.
So is an iguana actually the mascot? I didn't actually see that.
Yeah, there's a Ziguana. So you can call it the Ziguana Sauna podcast. There you go. Done. It's a fork.
Okay. All right. Maybe I'll take a look at that. All right. Again, thank you for your time. Maybe we'll have you back later on to talk more about what's going on with Zig. I think I'm happy that it can give us an explanation finally, because I've been asking people and I haven't really gotten that. And you definitely give a very good outlook on it. And so hopefully this inspires people to take a look at it. And maybe you'll have 41 or 43 people come into Milan. Who knows?
Well, thank you for your time. Nice to meet you, Alan. And I hope you enjoy your coffee and the rest of your day.
And enjoy your tea, right? Hopefully it doesn't make you stay up too late tonight. It's nighttime for you, right?
Yeah, no problem. Oolong tea is low caffeine.
Yeah, okay, well, you're lucky in that one. All right, thanks again for your help. And I'll catch you again next time.
Take care.